signed up, but how many in the room would like to offer comments? Just show a hand so we can. Okay, good. So what we're going to do is Troy is the hearing officer here. He's going to open it, and I will get. I'm going to time it to 5 minutes. I'll let you know about 4 minutes in if we're going long. And we'll get through everybody that wants to, and then if we have more time, we'll come back, and if folks want to revise or extend, we can do that. So, Troy, if you want to start us, I'll...
Good evening. This is a public meeting for Alaska National Interest Lands Conservation Act ANILCA 810 hearing for the Alaska Roadless Rule. My name is Troy Heithecker, and I've been delegated by the United States Forest Service as the hearing officer for this proceeding. I'd like to welcome everyone who came tonight, and hopefully the Southeast RAC member that will be joining us called in. I appreciate your interest in the Alaska Roadless Rule and your effort to attend this subsistence hearing. For the record, today is November 7th, 2019, and the time is 7:05 p.m. This hearing is being held in Petersburg, Alaska. The purpose of this hearing is to receive your views on the alternatives proposed for the project and how they may affect your subsistence use of the project area. The hearing hours this evening are scheduled from 7 to 9 p.m., unless we get through everyone and we're finished a little bit early here. If you have not done so, please sign in on the sign-in sheet. Clearly print your name, address, and if you're representing anyone, and indicate if you would like to give oral testimony tonight. That was at the sign-in sheet at the front. You can still sign up or as you come up. Written testimony will also be accepted tonight. There are paper and pens available. We can make them available at the sign-in table. When giving testimony, please begin by stating your full name. Testimony will initially be limited to 5 minutes per attestant. After all attestants have been heard, an additional 5 minutes may be granted if time allows. During the hearing, no questions can be answered other than those concerning the hearing procedures. Are there any questions related to the hearing at this time?
Is it going to be recorded?
Yes, ma'am. The recorder's on.
And transcribed?
Yes.
Yes.
How many people did you count?
I have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 signed up as yes, and then another 5 as maybes. I think that probably is about representing 12 or so on the raising
hand. Not till 9 o'clock.
Yeah. Okay, any other questions? Okay, with that, we'll get started. I'll just go through the list of the people that signed up, then I'll go through the maybes, and then we can see if there was anyone else we didn't get to for this first round. First name on the list is Joe Sebastian. Turn the recorder towards you if that's okay.
Hi, my name is Joe Sebastian. I've been following forest issues since about 1983 and a little earlier than that, but it just took me that long to get to the Forest Service office, talk to Charlie Gass and Ketchikan. This plan is just the latest plan in a long line of disasters. It just keeps getting worse and worse. The Central Tongass plan, the Big Thorn, Prince of Wales plan. I mean, that's what I was trying to say. It's just one thing after another. Every 6 months, every year, and you say the governor wants this, the governor, well, of course. They're trying to gin up economic activity and damn the torpedoes. But the people that actually use and utilize these areas, the economic opportunity doesn't even begin to compensate for what's being lost. Because the other day I recited all the clear cuts in the Tongass, from mental health to pulp mills to university to all the different native corporations, and it's about a list about this long. We've got clear cuts and roads coming out our ears, and having lived on Prince of Wales, I got a pretty up close to it. And just being a greenhorn, the first thing I notice is these guys don't respect this place. To them, it's a buck. Get the buck out. And I've visited numerous clear cuts and seen all the garbage and trash left laying there and the huge mess. It's impassable. Clear cut's impassable for at least 30 years and maybe even up to 50. And then nowadays, because of tightness of money, I can only say the half-ass management, like on Kosciuszko Island. Well, you guys take care of it. Best management practices. Let us know how it turns out. I can just about guess how that kind of stuff turns out. And when nobody's looking, things always go another way. And I know story after story after story of clear cuts moved across the other side of the valley and everything else. Logs stolen, log rafts disappearing. It's been a long haul. And to have this is just like the final indignity. It's like, no, thank you. No action alternative is the only sensible alternative, because the whole purpose of roadless was man can't help himself. He just got to keep going and go. Look, we've only been in 1806, Lewis and Clark cross. That's the whole thing since 1806. We've run through the whole works, and now we're down to the last little scraps at the bottom of the barrel. 200 years, give or take a decade and counting. 200 years from a virgin wilderness, screaming wilderness filled of native tribes, hardly no cities west of the Mississippi, save Santa Fe, perhaps, Taos, native cities. Look where we're at now, trying to whittle down the last of the last, and that's what we're talking about here. And it's extremely offensive, and I lose a lot of sleep over it. And this fellow wants to say, well, it's we can equivalate the climate change is the same. Well, not according to the scientists. Even the Pope said deforestation, major deforestation, is a global threat. Well, I believe it is. And just day before yesterday, I was up on the mountainside. The trees hold up the mountains around here, not the other way around. 6, maybe 8 foot trees. I don't know how old they were. 600, 800 years old. And there's my little mite, 2/3 or 3/4 run through my time on earth. And there's these giants. And we're arguing about trees that were standing there before your parents were born. Before your grandparents were born, those trees were standing there. You don't even know who their grandparents were before that time. And
about 30 seconds.
It's extremely offensive, and I don't care how you sell it. The Alaskan public's going to fight this tooth and nail. It's going to be in court for years. And as soon as politicians... As soon as we get a kind of drain the swamp, we're going to have another whack at this. And this next time around, we'll try to get it done right to stop this from happening.
Thank you, Joe. David Beebe?
Hi, my name is David Beebe. I would like to do it. Is that all I have to say? Okay. I'd like to remind the agency that began cutting Mitkoff Island in the 60s, and in the course of 2 winters in a row, completely decimated a prior deer factory into a state of irreparable harm. A 17-year deer hunting closure occurred. And ever since that time, ever since it has reopened, it has resulted in Mitkoff Island being the lowest, most restricted deer hunting in the entire region. I would like to remind the agency also that a survey of Southeast communities occurred by the Alaska Department of Fish and Game in 1961. And prior to this cutting, Petersburg was had the highest hunter success rate and demonstrated the highest dependence on deer. And the consequences of limiting our ability to get off the island, or basically forcing us to get off the island during the worst time of the year, results in, hazard, threat, risk. And this couldn't be any more clearly represented than the three crosses that are on the beach on Kuprinoff Island, where Cake residents were forced to go to Admiralty at the wrong time of the year, and they are no longer with us because of this. And this happens a lot. So the credibility of the agency to actually rise to the occasion of Section 810, boy, you've got one heck of a track record that really needs to be understood as a crisis of confidence. And the same thing goes in terms of crisis of confidence with the consequences of the Washington Office Activity Review and its demonstrated systemic contempt for the National Environmental Policy Act. It's a hard sell for us who have immersed ourselves in the Freedom of Information Acts and other means of trying to make sense of what we read and come to any other conclusion other than we have a systemic problem that's based upon Alaska rules, and we've got big problems because of that. And it is astonishing that the agency, 3 years after the fact, has done nothing more than allow the perpetrators to either retire with their benefits intact or get promoted. So I would like to point out that there is only one feasible alternative here, and that is no action, based on what we, as the public, understand. What pressures are, this is not to indict any person in this agency. I know the agency, I have many friends in the agency. This is really about a systemic problem, a top-down directive that will decide whether or not you get promoted. And let's face it, we deserve better. So please, please consider the fact that there are people who depend upon the resources of the Tongass, and based on that, please do nothing but no alternative.
Thank you.
No action alternative.
Next on the list, I have Joanne Kautzer. I got your name right.
Yeah, kind of close. My name's Joan Kautzer, and I'm speaking for myself. And I guess I would like to say my analogy for roadless is that it's kind of like a childproof cap on medicine. And it doesn't keep the people that are supposed to be in there out, but it does keep people that are, children or whatever, from getting into the bottle. I lived on Prince of Wales for over 20 years, and 3,500 miles of logging roads did not bring prosperity to that island. So here's my testimony. On a sunny day in September 2018, I attended a scoping meeting in Point Baker wherein the Forest Service and state tried to convince the locals that the new Alaskan version of the roadless rule needed to be crafted. Further, that the process would be responsive to the public and reflect what Alaskans wanted. Unanimously, everybody in attendance stated that they wanted the roadless rule to be left alone. We were informed that what we said at the meeting didn't count. Write formal comments and submit them. Fast forward, the U.S. Forest Service received 144,000 formal comments, well over 90% supported taking no action to change the roadless rule. So tonight, I know that once again, what I say doesn't count. I'm testifying when there is already a predetermined outcome. I'm participating in a public process that disregards the public. It's a process that it's public in name only. For 40 years, I've been procuring and eating subsistence foods, fish, shellfish, venison, sea vegetables, beech greens, berries, fiddleheads, and mushrooms. And I've gathered medicinals as well, usnea, sundews, devil's clubs, yew berries, and golden thread. Subsistence nourishes the body and the spirit. The food is clean, healthy, and meaningful. Meaningful because it solidifies our bond to the rainforest and maritime ecosystem. Subsistence is harvesting from the fat of the land. It's akin to living off the interest of a trust fund. As long as the trust fund is in place, we can continue to reap the benefits. Repealing roadless will bankrupt this region. If the Forest Service was trying to come up with a plan to eliminate subsistence, I'd say, yep, this ought to do it. During the last 70 years of intensive logging, great swaths of fish and wildlife habitat have been destroyed. With over 5,000 miles of logging roads, there are accompanying 5,000 miles of clear cuts. Watersheds have been creamed, damaging fish streams, leaving a backlog of plug culverts and restoration projects that will never be funded. Closed canopy second row stands do not provide forage for deer. Our fish and wildlife species are old growth dependent. It'll be hundreds of years before new growth begins to mimic the carrying capacity conditions of old growth habitat. And that's provided the soil and climatic conditions allow it to survive. Basically, there is no mitigating for wildlife once the old growth is cut. It's imperative to leave the last roadless tracks alone. When something is wrong on one level, it's generally wrong on a lot of levels. Today's timber industry employs very few people. By their own reckoning, Alcan employs about 50 people, and the Viking Mill employs about 40 people. Yet the timber industry gets an annual $24 million taxpayer subsidy and wants to lay claim to the remaining public forest lands, the same forest lands that drive the true economic engines of the region, commercial fishing and tourism. Something is very wrong with this picture when multinationals with log ships take precedent over the interests of the region's real economy. 48 projects have been approved in roadless areas since 2009, including community access, hydro development, and mining exploration. The rule is not impeding community progress. In the face of climatic change, these roadless areas are more important than ever, especially since the Tongass, the world's largest carbon sink, is the world's largest carbon sink. The most intact ecosystems have the best chance of surviving the future climate events.
30 seconds.
We owe it to the next generations to leave what's left of the Tongass as standing old growth. Lastly, I find it reprehensible that funding rural schools is held hostage to clear-cutting and round log exporting the Tongass. That's like saying, I'll buy you new gym shoes and a laptop, but I'm squandering your college savings fund. These public lands are their rightful legacy, and maintaining the roadless rule is the only assurance that they'll inherit anything worth having, including the subsistence lifestyle. I support the no-action alternative. Thank you.
Thank you, Jeremy. Next, I have Dan Sullivan.
Hi, my name is Dan Sullivan. Okay. I've lived on the Tongass for close to 40 years. I use the Tongass extensively for many, many subsistence activities, and I'm most concerned about loss of deer habitat in the roadless areas that might occur. I would support alternative number one, the no action alternative, and I oppose alternative number six. I would like to read the following statement. While the Tongass National Forest is the largest intact temperate rain, the Tongass National Forest is the largest intact temperate rainforest on the planet. While its value as a well of resources can be quantified and monetized, its value as an intact and unspoiled ecosystem cannot be calculated. It is priceless. But this ecosystem, already transforming due to climate change, is facing enormous challenges from a more serious threat, politics. President Trump, Senator Sullivan, Murkowski, Congressman Young, and Governor Dunleavy have all publicly stated their dogged mission to pursue a determined and aggressive rollback of environmental protections in Alaska. According to the Washington Post, President Trump has instructed Agriculture Secretary Sonny Perdue to exempt Alaska's Tongass National Forest from logging restrictions after a private discussion with Dunleavy aboard Air Force One. In a letter dated back to April 2015, Sonny Perdue, Secretary of Agriculture, told Andrew Mack, then the Commissioner of the Department of Natural Resources in Alaska, that we share your interest in exploring options to help create jobs and prosperity for rural communities in Southeast Alaska, and the forest product sector has long been a part of this economy. We want to ensure that we continue to contribute to the health of the rural economy in Alaska by investing in the sustainability, health, and productivity of our national forest. I would challenge that the forest product sector contributed little to the long-term health of our rural economy and instead gave us a short-term boom that busted when costs became too high, markets collapsed, subsidies ended, and the timber industry failed to modernize and innovate. The Forest Service reports that the Tongass produces 25% of the West Coast commercial salmon catch. Fishing and tourism bring in more than $2 billion to Alaska annually. Logging accounts for less than 1% of the jobs in Southeast Alaska. A couple hundred jobs is an estimate I've heard. Timber sales on the Tongass still lose money. They're heavily subsidized. Much of the wood that is harvested is still exported with very little domestic processing. Some say that the roadless rule inhibits necessary infrastructure projects from occurring, but my understanding is that since the roadless rule was enacted, the Forest Service has approved all 58 project requests it has received for roads in Alaska. I'd like to finish by reading a quote from Mike Dombeck, the former chief of the Forest Service, in an editorial in the Los Angeles Times. It goes, "Nevertheless, Alaska's congressional delegation and its governor, pushed primarily by logging interests, want an exemption from the roadless rule. But decisions that affect our shared lands shouldn't be made at the behest of special interests. They should be made by professional land managers and informed by science, not politics. The roadless rule has served our national forests well. It affirms a basic truth. Most Americans value their public lands for clean water, healthy habitat, and recreational opportunities they provide. Over a century ago, President Theodore Roosevelt's Secretary of Agriculture, James Wilson, wrote that the national forests should be managed for the greatest good, for the greatest number, for the long run. We urge the President and Secretary Perdue to follow this sage advice and do what is best for the long-term health of the land and future generations of America." That was from Mike Dombeck. I would echo that I urge you to leave the roadless rule intact and unchanged for the long-term health of the Tongass and for the future generations of Alaskans and every American. Thank you.
Next on the list, I have Toby Cook.
I'm Toby Cook, and I represent myself. The roadless rule has handicapped the economy of our Southeast communities long enough. It has totally decimated an industry that once directly supported our schools and roads, and indirectly our doctors, hospitals, and local businesses. Logging once supported many of our communities. As jobs were lost, families moved away, taking students with them. Southeast needs to develop its infrastructure. Power, water, and transportation needs must be met soon. The recent loss of one of our underwater cables should be a wake-up call to everyone. The power grid is totally lacking in alternatives. and leaves us dependent on expensive diesel fuel as a backup. The proposed intertidal cake, should it be run along the shoreline of Frederick Sound, would open many opportunities for both communities. Should the state hold any more land acquisition rights, they could file a land claim to DNR and auction land out of the 1,000-foot buffer strip along the beach. This would not only be a great benefit for our tax base, but also open up desperately needed entry-level jobs for our youth as new lodges and outfitters, hired baiters, fish cleaners, and winter watchmen, etc. The federal funding that took over the timber tax could be on the chopping block at any time. We need to prepare to have alternative options in place before this happens. The ferry service is in jeopardy at this moment. What's next? The Essential Air Service program, which subsidizes flights to our remote southeast villages, or the Power Cost Equalization Program, a fuel subsidy? Fuel costs have made recreational travel by boat and charter plane cost prohibitive, and road travel is a cheaper alternative for many. As barge and fuel shipping prices increase, it's time to reconsider a road or rail connection through Canada to the lower 48. As we have limited time frame here tonight, I have cut this short. I have a few printed flyers in the back that covers many facts about the issues at hand. Please read them and share them amongst friends. A lot of facts have been misrepresented in these issues, and I encourage the public to look them up for themselves. Thank you.
Thanks, Toby. Next, Suzanne Wood.
My name is Suzanne Wood, and I'm a resident of Petersburg. It will be hard to resist changing the forest plan and increase the annual timber harvest if the Tongass exemption is approved and another 180,000 acres are open for potential timber harvest. I oppose the Tongass roadless rural exemption. I support the U.S. Forest Service turning its assets into carbon sequestration resources as a formidable defense against an ever-increasing global climate catastrophe. I support the no-action alternative, Alternative 1. Thank you for this opportunity to comment.
Thank you, Suzanne. Next on the list, I have Austin Carlson. What's that?
It's Colson.
Oh, Colson, sorry.
My handwriting's not
very good. Oh, I think it was our translation of your.
Hello, my name is Austin Colson. I am a recent transplant to southeastern Alaska. I came from northern Missouri, where there are no roadless areas. There are no old growths left standing. Everything has been clear cut. Everything has been converted into fields, farmlands, etc. If you want to go deer hunting, you have to find a farmer who's willing to let you hunt on his land. If you want to go fishing, you have to find someone who hasn't already claimed exclusive water rights, or find a public alternative, which can be difficult. I am deeply concerned that removing the roadless rule or exempting it in southeastern Alaska could turn southeastern Alaska into much of what I moved from. I believe I speak for myself, my father, my mother, and my little brother, who all moved here about 6 months ago, when we say that we would wholeheartedly like to, in the future, take advantage of Alaska's abundant resources and continue to live here. However, due to my concerns and my, I would like to say, scientifically minded perspective, I am concerned that removing or exempting southeastern Alaska, specifically the Tongass, from the roadless rule will only increase clear cutting, decrease old growth, as well as decrease biodiversity in the region. I am concerned that an exemption would destroy natural watersheds as well as endanger many local and endemic species. As it has been stated before tonight, the old growth is one of the largest carbon sequestration sites in North America and potentially the world. However, new growth does not sequester carbon as well as old growth due to the biodiversity, mosses, trees, etc. I have also witnessed many clear-cut sites in southeastern Alaska where the land is not managed afterwards. Clear-cutting is left a horrible mess. The land can't be used for anything. You just have to sit and wait and hope that one day it returns to normal. I am concerned that an exemption to the roadless rule will turn more of southeastern Alaska into those clear-cut areas. And I am concerned that that will endanger both my future and any potential descendants I may have down the line, and could cause us to potentially leave Alaska one day if its abundant natural resources become unavailable to the public due to either mismanagement or due to lack of caring. I'm not trying to indict anyone or say that anyone in any agency is responsible, but rather that there are larger interests at play and that I personally support the alternative one, no action. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Austin. Did we have someone from the Southeast Subsistence Rack join us on the phone?
Yes, you did.
And who's on the line, please?
This is Don Hernandez.
Hi, Don. This is Dave Schmidt, and Troy Hightecker is the hearing officer. We've begun. We're moving through, and so, Don, if we've still got a few more folks here, at least on a first round, and then if you could maybe mute your phone if you're listening in, that would help us, and then we'll call on you as we get through the list. Will that work?
I'm just going to listen in. I'm not going to testify at this session.
Okay. All right. Thanks, Don.
Okay.
Thanks.
Yeah, thanks, Dave.
Next, I have a list of maybes, and the first on there is Mike Stanbrook. Stanbrook?
And you're recording?
Yes, it's on that
mic. Excellent. All right. Hello, my name is Mike Stanbrook. Tonight I'm representing myself. I live here in Petersburg, and I've lived either here or in the city of Kupernov since 1992, when Ethel registered me to vote. Anyway, I wish to speak clearly to the notion of the roadless rule exemption and subsistence. I do not favor a roadless rule exemption. Alternative one, the no action alternative needs to be chosen. I rely on the Tongass to provide commercial, sport, recreational, and subsistence opportunities. I subsistence fish, gather berries, mushrooms, hunt deer, and gather firewood. I'm thankful for the bounty of this place. The salmon require an intact forest. The Sitka black-tailed deer need those old-growth south-facing slopes. Shipping our habitat overseas diminishes our subsistence possibilities and our future. The U.S. Forest Service mission statement is to sustain the health, diversity, and productivity of the nation's forests and grasslands to meet the needs of present and future generations. That's the Forest Service mission statement. Let's consider the last part about future generations. To meet the needs of future generations and to provide for subsistence and to actually use the science of climate change, no action alternative is required. I do not support a roadless rule exemption. Thank you.
Thank you, Mike. Next I have Kelly O'Connor Dimko.
I think she's here. I don't think she's here.
Okay.
She left.
Okay. Next is Melina Marvin.
Hi.
Hi.
Thanks, you guys. I don't have prepared remarks, but since there's time, I'll just say that my husband and I live here. We have land on Kupernov Island, and we use the East Kupernov roadless areas quite a bit for all manner of foraging the way that most of our community does, berries, mushrooms, seaweed off the shores. Deer, our chest freezer is full right now with moose and deer from this year. Fish, obviously, we also commercial fish. And both of us really clearly oppose what you're trying to do here. And I just, as much as truth matters anymore, I think it has to be said that this whole thing is just a sham and 100% corrupt. And you're hearing hear what people actually think, and yet you're trying to do something that's coming from somewhere else. And it just doesn't square with us on the ground. Just doesn't square. And we oppose it. And because it's, you know, subsistence regulatory process, I'm telling you that I use the land and I'm concerned about the impacts, and I support a no action alternative, and I would appreciate locally driven bottom up regulatory process to the extent that we can do it, and I think that we can, but people have to make it happen. That's all I got.
Thank you.
Rebecca Knight.
Hello. Hello, my name is Rebecca Knight. I'm a 44-year resident of Petersburg and the Kuprinoff Island area. First, most people view this proposed full Tongass exemption of the rule to be the direct result of a brief visit by Governor Dunleavy with President Trump aboard Air Force One. This resulted in an almost immediate top-down edict from the Secretary of Agriculture to fully exempt the Tongass from the roadless rule. This was also heartily embraced by Senator Murkowski, who has been pushing for every single angle to get public timber into the hands of industry via any means possible, including privatization of our public lands. It is a major overreach. So much for ANILCA 810 public input and scientific analysis. Locally harvested Sitka black-tailed deer comprised about 95% of the red meat in my family's diet, as well as both of my sons and their families, for a total of 8 individuals. Our other protein needs come from local wild seafood, including salmon, halibut, and shellfish. By late November every year, our goal is to have meat from 4 to 6 deer in our freezer to get us to the next season. This year, we ran out about a month ago with only about 4 deer in the freezer from last November. I support the no action alternative for a number of reasons, including the impact to my family's subsistence needs at the expense of guaranteeing profits to Alcan Transpac Group of Vancouver, BC, and Viking Lumber of Klawak. These two timber barons and international raw log exporters ship the bulk of our natural wealth to China. Moreover, the Forest Service has no business opening up areas which currently do not even meet, naturally or as a result of logging, the T-Lump standard and guideline of supplying a habitat capability of 18 deer per square mile in exchange for the exclusive benefit of a few Alcan and Viking jobs. Moreover, in cases where habitat capability is below the 18 deer per square mile T-Lump threshold, your agency shields itself behind the where possible clause to sanction yet more logging and roading rather than opting for a no further harm philosophy. This is unethical. And to that end, I'd like to, perhaps there is a layer in the DEIS, I haven't seen it yet, of all the wildlife analysis areas in relation to the roadless areas and the habitat capability at STEM exclusion 45 years and beyond. Please keep in mind that simply because habitat capability has been reduced to rock bottom in some areas does not mean it should be exploited further as a sacrifice zone. And speaking of sacrifice zones, I look at the Alt 6 map there and I see that most of the chosen exemptions are concentrated in central to southern southeast Alaska that's already has been absolutely nuked, and you guys know it. The Forest Service must take reasonable steps to ensure not just viable but harvestable levels of wildlife populations, in particular for deer, and this requires providing for wolves that also prey on deer. Now that much of the Tongass' high-value deer winter range has been clear-cut, what little habitat remains is vitally important, including all deer habitat, low, mediocre, high, and the highest-value deer winter range, as well as leaf strips that serve as important elevational corridors for wildlife. In reality, these leaf strips are seldom left, but rather absorbed into new clear cuts only a few years after a few years, resulting in creeping mega cuts that are wastelands for wildlife. I believe the demand for deer in Southeast Alaska is much greater than the harvest. For instance, my son, who is an excellent shot, and I have no prejudice there, recently harvested one deer on McCuff Island on a two-day hunt. He had a designated deer tag in his possession both days. As I understand, there are many more designated tags issued than actually used, which is a statement to the big demand for deer and consequently the need to protect more habitat, not less. My husband just returned from a four-day hunt to Admiralty just last night with two friends where they normally experience good hunting success. However, they only harvested three deer. For Admiralty, this is likely a function of mild weather and their desire to not go deep into brown bear country. But they hope to return when the snow brings the deer down to lower elevations, but this means another expensive trip across the big waters of Frederick Sound during a time of rough seas. Others who have done the same have lost their lives or nearly so while crossing. My husband and kids have been overdue on several occasions waiting out late fall storms. For those without the means to get to areas with greater abundance, hunters often stop hunting altogether. This fact is substantiated in a study by Sigmund and Dorr, who explained that many of the Petersburg deer hunters travel to GMU 4, game management unit 4 on Admiralty, because hunter success is relatively good. And I'm going to have to shorten up what I have here, but I reserve my right to speak longer later.
Sure.
ANILCA mandates that wildlife resources in customary and traditional use areas like Petersburg and Kuprinov are available in close proximity to rural residents. Proceeding with a major reclassification of Tongass wildlands for the singular benefit to industry blatantly ignores that mandate. And with that in mind, I think the DEIS was deficient on any kind of analysis for wildlife. So I have a buddy that worked on the FIBOP committee back in 1997, the Conservation Strategy for Wildlife. And I asked him, did that strategy consider roadless areas? And of course it didn't, because roadless areas were enacted in 2001. But, and I'm going to read to you exactly what he said. He said, "We emphasize that the habitat conservation areas alone were not sufficient to maintain viable, well-distributed populations. They would need a reasonable matrix between. A key bottleneck for the Forest Service was the NIFMA requirement that populations be well-distributed." So, to go on, how much longer do I have there?
You're over.
I'm out. Okay, yeah. I'll be back if I can.
Thank you.
The last name I have on the list is Bill Tremblay. I think he's not.
So he tried to make it back.
Okay.
Written comments.
Was there anyone else that wanted to provide comments? Thank you.
Hey, I'm Jim Martinson, representing myself today. I'm a third generation Alaskan, born and raised. It's my whole life here. I work commercially fishing and construction, a little bit of logging since the early 80s. A lot of time over in Southeast Alaska in the woods, fishing, hunting, probably more than I should have on some falls, but spent an awful lot of time out there. I'm not for the Roadless Act. I would like to see something change in that effect. And what I've seen tonight, you guys are looking at all alternatives, and I think that's a good thing. I think we need to find a common ground that we as a region can survive and not deplete our resources. Tongass is a national forest, not a national park. It's multi-use, and we got to. It's your guys' responsibility to treat it that way and give the loggers some trees to cut, give the miners some stuff to do. That's what multi-use is, just by the general nature of it. Fishing, timber harvest, mining, recreation. We do two of them really well. We do recreation, and we do fishing top-notch. We overdo it in some cases. I think we do lack in the timber and the mining and the other parts of the forest that are supposed to be open for economic development. That said, I think we're smart enough now as a society that we're not going to revert back to the timber harvest levels of the 70s, 80s, and 90s. And, you know, it was a little overextended in that period, and I think we've learned from that, and we're smarter because of that. So I don't see this as a big impact that if we open this up, we're going to sculpt the Tongass. It's just not going to happen just with the nature of what we have in place now and the people we have here. I trust that the process is going to take care of itself. So I don't think we need more regulation on top of the stuff you have to deal with already. I think we need to get in and be able to extend the areas that we've logged in already and be able to go back in there and try to get this thing to a cycle where we can continue to go through, and eventually these are the logging areas, these are the places we're not touched, we won't be having these kind of discussions anymore because it'd be well established. But where we're at now is we're at a lull producing wise where now the mills are shut down. I've heard people talk, well, there's only a couple of mills left. Well, there used to be a lot more, even smaller scale mills that when you put 10, 15, 20 jobs into a community, that's a big boost. These are small communities. Those things help. Every dollar helps. Timber sales used to pump a lot of money into schools. Timber receipts would. I don't know the exact numbers, but there was a big chunk of timber receipts, which was basically a timber tax that went back into the schools. Nowadays, we got raw fish tax. We got tourist head tax, but guess what all those monies go to? They go to infrastructure that accommodates those industries. They don't go to schools. They don't go to the average people to help us educate our kids. They're very constrictive. They keep the money within the industry. So the timber industry is, I like that. I think we need that. Ferry systems are, they're going to shut down. We don't have enough economic base, enough people traveling around, we're going to lose everything we've come to want and need. And if we don't find a way to turn things around and not rely on tourism and fishing, this town's one bad fishing season away from people locking stuff up. That's the way I view it. So you couple that up with tourism, which tourism is not a clean source. I mean, we got these big ships coming through. I don't know what their carbon footprint is, but it's bellowing out the top and coming out the bottom. That's been proven. I'd like to talk a little bit about the hunting part of it there, because I'll probably give you a little different perspective on it. I spent many hours in the woods, and I would kind of blame the forest a little bit on the deer habitat, but it's only because you gave us access. That's the biggest thing. If you're hunting old-growth timber on the beachfront, people behind you and for the last are getting the deer because they're up on the road system. It has nothing to do. The more deer in the clear cuts, there's more forage for them in the clear cuts. I've had more success in clear cuts around clear cuts and on the roads than I have in the timber. It's adaption. I've figured out that if I go to places where it's just old growth forest, I'm not going to see much. I'll give you another example. Real quick?
Go for it.
Okay. Moose population in southeast, this area here, non-existent before the 50s. Thomas Bay was the first place. It came right after the logging came in. Moose come in afterwards. Moose milk came from Stikine, Thomas Bay, Mitkoff, Cooper Moff, all the way out to QU. We rely on that as a subsistence now because it's a major protein source. So, we got to find the common ground. And continue on.
Thank you. Okay, was there anyone else who wanted to provide testimony this evening?
I'll go again if no one else wants to.
Please. Okay.
This is Rebecca Knight again.
During the last 6 to 7 decades, there has been a significant loss of intact habitat Tongass-wide, resulting in greatly diminished abundance for species like Sitka black-tailed deer. This is particularly so in localized areas, for instance, in a portion of Game Management Unit 3, where hunters there have experienced the most restrictive hunting season in southeast Alaska, including a 17, I think I already said this. As wildlife experts have acknowledged, periods of low deer abundance are usually preceded by a series of severe winters, and periods of a high deer abundance preceded by mild winters. That's just to put it simple. I consider the public lands habitat that provide not only viable but huntable populations of deer for subsistence use to be among the highest of any asset public land can supply. Therefore, I request that there be no further loss of deer winter range, be it high, medium, or low, as this will certainly happen under the proposed exemption, and that you abandon this gutting of the rule as the only way that that goal can be accomplished. I'd also like to see the cumulative economic loss of deer to subsistence hunters over time disclosed. The Forest Service should analyze and disclose the cumulative economic losses of deer to subsistence hunters over time as part of the EIS's cumulative effects economic analysis. I think there needs to be a cumulative effects analysis. For instance, during the 1961 season, this is a jaw-dropping figure, 1,922 deer were harvested from Unit 3, where deer habitat at that time was largely intact. This computes to $961,000 worth of meat in today's dollars, and likely a close estimate of today's value had the habitat remained intact. This is a staggering loss of economic value and far more precious than a sea of clear cuts and fragmented landscapes that result from Viking and Alcan's activities. According to the Forest Service, the proposed rule would effectively bring only 185,000 acres, about 2%, out of 9.2 million designated as inventoried roadless areas on the Tongass into the set of lands that may be considered for logging. You also claim that this improved flexibility could in turn improve the Forest Service's ability to offer economic timber sales that better meet the needs of timber industry and can contribute to rural economies. You need to look at other economic sectors as well. But regardless, I bet dollars to donuts that these acres have been carefully overlaid on timber volume maps with input from industry and comprise the very best of the rest of the high volume stands of trees remaining on the Tongass, which the industry has yet to access. While the amount of acreage appears small relative to the overall size of the Tongass, the public lands that the exemption seeks to obtain for logging include probably some of the region's richest and most biologically productive sites. One measure of this is tree size on any given acre, not just board feet, but tree size. These large trees are not only disproportionately valuable economically for wood volume, these same areas provide vitally and increasingly scarce habitat for a variety of Tongass wildlife. Large tree stands on the Tongass, identified as a class 6 and 7, comprise just 3% of the Tongass or the National Forest land base. How much acreage do they comprise under the above claim? How many of those acres sought by industry for logging will eliminate remaining class 7 biggest tree stands on the Tongass? If this is true, it will create a disproportionate negative impact on wildlife populations that depend on these stands for cover from deep winter snow like deer, or for security along salmon streams. This is also important, that's from black and brown bears. It's also important to note that historic timber sales entailed intensive high grading of the highest habitat old growth. The timber industry has already removed nearly half of the large tree old growth forests from Kuprinoff and Mitkoff Islands. This means that past logging has significantly reduced the current winter carrying capacity for deer. This proposal for the exemption continues to target the most accessible and best remaining deer habitat on the Tongass, for example, along the Green Rocks roadless area. and other roadless areas on Mitkoff Island, just to name a few. And in my written comments to you, to be specific, I will list those roadless areas by roadless area number. The prevalence of disproportionate removals of prime deer winter habitat is extreme throughout the Petersburg-Kuprinoff community use area. Kuprinoff and Mitkoff Island both have experienced greater declines in winter deer habitat than most of the Tongass. Also, these areas have the second lowest amount of deer winter habitat protected in conservation reserves. Over the past decade, the Forest Service has concentrated its timber sale program in this area and on Prince of Wales Island. Simply put, this concentration of timber of logging is unfair to subsistence users from Petersburg and Kuprinoff. It also fails to heed ANILCA's mandate to ensure that wildlife resources in customary and traditional use areas are available in close proximity to rural residents. And with the best habitat gone now and with canopy closure occurring 25 to 40 years after logging, depending on location, what is occurring is a continual succession debt on the habitat. Following canopy closure, a virtual forage desert predominates. And now, in the later decades, year by year, the debt is being paid at a high price in terms of the amount of deer available to hunters and wolves. Proposed restoration activities, such as thinning, fail to protect the resource on a meaningful scale, nor will their effects be sustained long term. And I'll leave it right there. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks. Appreciate it.
Yeah. Austin?
Fine.
Okay. Hello again, this is Austin Colson. I just wanted to add a short bit to my testimony. After witnessing the devastation caused by clear cutting, I am not yet against the export of timber from Southeast Alaska. I believe that the export of timber is a vital and key resource that Southeast Alaska has to offer. However, I believe that due to the poor management, it is not sustainable to allow more areas to be open to clear cutting, which would be possible if the proposed option 6 were to be upheld. I believe that if Southeast Alaska and could show that we could manage areas that have been clear cut in the past and help rehabilitate them in a meaningful and useful way instead of just leaving them to rot or leaving them as piles of debris that will take decades to regenerate themselves. I believe that if we could in some way show that we could rehabilitate these lands and put them on a sustainable cycle, then I would not be... I still support no action. However, I believe it would be a viable alternative to opening more areas to clear cutting. Thank you.
Is there anyone else in the room that wanted to comment?
I'll go part two. I'll rush through the last part. Sorry. Jim Martin's in part two. Yeah. Yeah. Where I left off on the moose populations is, and I watched it really close in Thomas Bay in the early 90s after the clear cuts became I would call prime for moose habitat. Thomas Bay had the highest moose population in the state of Alaska, like 6.1 moose per square mile. Since that's the timber has grown up, it's gotten beyond a height that would sustain the moose population, and now it's dropped back down to one of the lowest in the state. It's a cycle for the moose, and you're seeing that now. We got moose all the way out in QU and Rowan Bay. They followed the migration, basically followed the clear cuts all the way out there, and now it's becoming an important subsistence product for the people in this area. One moose will take care of about 10, 15 deer if you're successful. So it's very important when it comes to subsistence. As far as the deer populations, it's purely predation. The access you've given us through the recreational part has made us better predators, and that's the biggest part in the 70s on this island even, that made the deer populations go down. Is all of a sudden these guys had access to them, and the deer had never seen that before. And humans being humans, they overextended themselves and just taken 20, 30 years for that to rebound back. I would encourage you guys to you know, even look at second manufacturing as part of this deal. I don't know what you guys get into it, but it would be nice to be able to get the jobs of the timber harvesting, but also to mill it and maybe even beyond that, put out a product, some incentive, something that we can start putting products out, or products we can even buy here locally that typically we have to barge in, so we can make our carbon infra even that much smaller, so we're not barging everything in from the lower 48. I think that would be a great benefit, and if this helps us get there, I'm all for it. I think it makes sense to have ability to choose where we can get the trees that you're going to manage every year, and if it makes more sense to do it in an area where there's existing roads, but now you can't go there because of the road slack, then we need to look at that and revamp that a little bit. I guess lastly, I just encourage people not to be hypocritical. I mean, if you live in a wood house on wood piling, drive out the road and use the road systems, you read a book or a newspaper, you hunt moose, you have a wood boat, you live on a lot that's been cut clear of trees so you can put up your house, and you use toilet paper on a regular basis, you can't be against the timber industry. We need to find a sustainable timber industry. I don't want anything to get out of control, but we need to do it in a responsible way. As far as the carbon part of it, trees die. 700-800 years, the trees are going to die. I don't know what how old the Tongass is at this moment, but there's a continual cycle of dead trees out there, and dead trees left standing are going to re-release the carbon back into the atmosphere. It's one way or the other. Eventually, when that tree is completely decomposed, all that carbon has gone back out. You haven't gained anything. Everything gets filtered in and built up, it's lost. By harvesting, you actually lock some of it for a short period of time until that wood is used or burned or gets demised. So I would venture to say that if we're in a crisis mode of, hey, we need to get our carbon under control, if we did some carbon locking, and there's places in the country that they're actually burying trees to lock the carbon in. When it gets to climate things, we gotta be aware of that, but we gotta be aware of if we let timber just stand, rot, and die, we haven't done anything in that whole and getting our carbon footprint, so to say, in balance, because it's going right back in. So I would encourage you guys to manage the forest well, do your job. I trust the people we put in place. You do it full time. You know what you're doing. We always have public input, so I'm not worried we're going to rape and pillage the whole countryside because we repeal a roadless act. Thanks.
Thank you. Anyone else?
I'm ready for a little break.